Park Place, Wednesday morning, 15th May 1974. This morning, let us draw all the threads together. The silence and the stillness, the meaning and significance of words, the purification of the mind and the heart, and the realization by transcendence of itself through the individual. Let us first consider the significance of words. From the religious point of view, it is very simple. The words of the language, of any language, represent that which is finite and particular, which comes into being and passes away. The whole verbal process, the whole discursive thought process, is confined to the sphere of mortality, therefore, the finite, that which dies, is confined to the sphere of ambivalence, where there are contrasts, dualities, multiplicities, and conflict. The conflict which is born of ignorance on the one hand, as well as our mental and moral defilements. These are the forces which set going the conflicts and which are the sources of the ill, the sorrow, which we see in the world, and also the sources of the temporary good, the ephemeral happiness that we experience. So the realm of words represents all this. But within the heart of man, there is this curious urge, this longing, sometimes so deeply hidden, sometimes so crushed in by external circumstance, that it never has the opportunity to find any sort of expression throughout one's whole life. And this urge is for an indefinable something, which is perfection, which is supreme fulfillment. And it is this urge which is the expression of the hidden transcendence within us, which somehow or other moves at least some of us in the right direction, in the direction which brings us to maturity mentally, psychologically, and enables us to realize our true manhood, our humanhood. Now, as we have seen during these days, or at least tried to see, the supreme instrument of growth spiritually is mindfulness. And with right mindfulness, the mind is cleansed of its defilements. Today we must emphasize the cleansing of the mind not only of defilements, which are obvious defilements, anybody can see them, but also of the burden of memories of past experience and the mental fixations in terms of ideas, beliefs, systems which purport to present the understanding of life, which purport to express transcendence. And this is a difficult part of our mental purification. It implies that we have to become free of every bias in us. Bias in the sense of a general leaning towards something in contradistinction to something else. And certainly of all prejudice, all preconception, and all our assumptions. Because these are all formulated in words, and words represent the finite. As long as all these finite particulars fill the mind, the realization of the non-finite, the free, the utterly pure, the transcendent, is not possible. We are the obstructors of transcendence. And therefore it becomes imperative to understand this so deeply, so completely, that although, of course, the process of daily life will inevitably throw up ideas in the actual process of living itself, we will not cling to the ideas. Thoughts, feelings, ideas, the belief of the moment, the perception of the moment, they all emerge simply because we are alive. They are the sign that we are alive here now as psychophysical organisms. But they all pass away. And we must let them go. We must not try to hold back the river of life. Let it flow. Otherwise, we obstruct that river of life and we cause eddies and whirlpools and find ourselves in difficulties. And worse still, we drag others into difficulty, trying to impose upon themselves our misconceptions and our ideas, trying to convert them, trying to do things for their good, which means that I am so conceited as to think that I know what is good for another. I can't let him live. This is the imposition of my ego. This is the satisfying of my power lust, converting the other person, doing something for his good. Leave everything alone. When there is the call for communication, for actual help, then give. Otherwise, be quiet. Isn't it true that the Holy of Holies, embodied in that word God, is the invisible, the inaudible, the inconceivable, the unknown? God leaves everything alone. And in that leaving everything alone, the cosmos subsists and remains a cosmos despite our interferences. So we have to learn that sort of thing. When we are perfectly still and silent, utterly pure, fully awake, wholly attentive, intensely sensitive in terms of the receiving of impressions and making the right response to them, fundamentally through understanding all the time, this quiet, silent understanding in which love, compassion and wisdom are beautifully harmonized, then we ourselves are in that state where transcendence flows freely into us and out of us, a benediction upon the world around us. When you or I are in that state, that is the meaning of the word Atma. That is the meaning of the word Brahman. So you will see, it is also the meaning of the word God. So you will see that all the intellectualist definitions, all the discussions and disputations and theological cobwebs spun out of the minds of men, which are filled with all sorts of particular finite ideas, merely misrepresent that which is beyond all representation. Let us look at that again. You yourself, utterly pure, still and silent, intensely receptive and responsive, wholly sensitive, unresisting, you are then the nexus through which this unknown and unknowable transcendent flows into you and out of you. You are transparent. You are actually in the state of the void. The void which is the plenitude, because this mysterious transcendent energy flows in and out. And this is the meaning of the word Atma or Brahman or God, the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, call it what you will. In one of the Yoga Upanishads, you find this stated in a simple and one of the clearest forms. It comes through many of the Upanishads, but this is about the simplest. It's in the Varaha Upanishad, in its second chapter, that which is consciousness alone, which is all-pervading, which is eternal, which is all full, which is of the nature of bliss, and which is indestructible, is the only true Brahman, the only true Atma. Now, even there, because it is presented in that form, one tends to start thinking of it as something separate, that which is consciousness alone. We are so conditioned as psychophysical organisms that when the word consciousness is used, we tend to project consciousness as a particular thing outside ourselves, just as a thought, an idea, a book, a chair. This is the trouble. That is why I put it in this form. You yourself, utterly pure, still and silent, intensely sensitive, transparent. When you are in that state and transcendence is flowing freely through you and out of you, all that is the meaning of the word Atma. It's not a thing, it's not a spirit, it is not an energy. It is just that, beyond us altogether. The Buddha uses the phrase vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabam. Vijnanam is discriminative consciousness in the ordinary way. But the Buddha uses it in the transcendent sense. He doesn't use another word, the other word which the Upanishads use, which I think is better to do that, is the word Atma. This phrase of the Buddha is the exact equivalent of the Upanishadic Atma. Vijnanam anidassanam. Consciousness which is without characteristics, anantam, endless, sabbato, everywhere, shining, accessible. Now you see why that word consciousness comes in. All that we know is in terms of mental constructs. When I say, I know you, the particular person, what I am knowing here and now as a psychophysical organism is the mental construct which I have made through my contacts with you. I have a picture of you in my mind. I don't know you in yourself, in your absolute isness. I don't know that. I only know my mental picture. And that is what I'm referring to when I say I know you. But as and when through perfect mindfulness, through the whole discipline of purification, all mental constructs are out, then when I see you, for the first time I am seeing the you exactly as you are in your actual isness. See, this is something very different. That is why and how, when the Holy One sees you, he knows you. You don't need to introduce yourself. He knows all about you at once. So, that is a case of pure consciousness, pure awareness. And you remember that I have mentioned during the course of these days that that awareness is identical with being. You are that which is conveyed to you through your senses. You are that in terms of mind, in terms of pure consciousness. Now, is that more or less clear? It is this state of awareness being, which is blissful, utterly blissful, which is the culmination of the spiritual life, and which is the fruition of the religious consciousness. In this state, you are in complete harmony, in perpetual communion, in total mindfulness all the time of all that is. Your mode of awareness of existence has at last undergone its complete transmutation. Now, do not think that this is the end of the journey, because we have long passed movement in any sort of temporal or spatial terms. This is the state of being, remember. I mentioned awareness being. And this is a vibrating, a thrilling, a living and a vibrating which is perpetual creative action in eternity. There is no beginning to it, there is no end to it. The realization of this state does not mean that, I have now finished my job. One could use a phrase like that, provided one was awake enough and intelligent enough to know that it does not mean cessation of life, because life is eternal. Life goes on forever and ever, which is not really a very good phrase to use, ever and ever, because it implies time. It is the timeless actuality, which knows no measurement. It is free of all confinement, all restriction. This is the actual experiencing of immortality during the lifetime of the organism as such. I wish I could, without using a single word, do something which could suddenly sort of wake you up to this extraordinary transcendence. But the wish is childish, because if I could do it, and I did it, it would take away from you the glory of God. The glory and the marvel and the beauty of the whole thing of life is that through you this happens. And because it happens through you, an individual, a unique individual being, that the variety and the wonder of transcendence, the glory which fills everything, becomes even more glorious, if one can speak in such terms. Now, let us appreciate again this business about words. You know how tiresome I am always telling everybody to shut up. Listen carefully. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, Adam has a fall which is redeemed by Jesus Christ. In the Iranian tradition, the great king Yama, who is not only a temporal king but also a spiritual, the spiritual leader, also has a fall, which is redeemed by Zarathustra. In the Rig Vedic tradition, strangely enough, there is no fall. In the Rig Vedic tradition, you will find these, there are very few hymns, just four or five, in the 10th book of the Rig Veda. In this Rig Vedic tradition about Yama, who becomes the lord of death, meaning he transcends death, he is not the death dealer, he transcends death. In the tradition about Yama, it is said that he chooses death, abandons the body, and enters the other world, the beyond, and is given lordship over the highest of the three heavens. You'll find this three heavens phrase in St. Paul also, Corinthians. What is the meaning of this? He chooses death, abandons his body, enters the other world, and is given lordship over the highest of the three heavens. He chooses death. What does he die to? He dies to all worldliness. It means that he undergoes all purification morally and mentally, by which he is no longer bound to that which is ill. He is no longer a producer of ill. This is the death which he chooses, and therefore he dies to all worldliness. He transcends the domination of the three lower chakras. And then comes that other aspect. All this which is manifestation is bound up with discursive thought and speech. All that belongs to our psychophysical life is intimately bound up with speech all the time. Everything is clothed in speech. Our thoughts, our feelings, our actions, our conceptions, everything is bound up in terms of speech. All the sense functions come to a state of peace. They are pacified. But they are not pacified in the way in which they are pacified when we go to sleep and enter the state of dreamless slumber. There is a pacification then, but that is the pacification in the unawakened state, literally the unawakened state. This is a case of the pacification of the sense functions, and therefore also the pacification of the flow of words, and the bondage of consciousness to the finite, the conflicting, the mortal. It's a pacification of all that whilst you are fully awake, intensely sensitive, as you never were sensitive before. This is the mystery. This is the realization, the making real of the silence, here and now. And this is the choosing of death. and abandoning the body. The body meaning that which is limited, which is mortal. He enters the beyond that other world. Obviously, all spatio-temporal meanings must be set aside here. They have no place in this mode of awareness. And is given lordship over the highest of the three heavens. There is another marvelous hymn in the 9th book of the Rig Veda, in which the seer prays to Soma, the Lord of Inspiration, saying, "Make me immortal in that realm which is filled with light, where reigns the king Yama, who has crossed beyond all death." So Yama is given lordship over the highest of the three heavens. Now consider, in psychological terms, what does that mean? If the whole speech process has quietened down and you are awake, you are intensely alive, in what mode are you conscious of all existence around you? If it is not in terms of sights, sounds, smells, tastes, experiences, events, and so forth, which is all the mortal mode of consciousness, in what mode are you conscious? In the mode in which there is no uprising, no beginning, no proceeding, no coming to an end. Therefore, no finitude and mortality. You are aware in the mode of immortality. The actual experiencing of immortality is taking place in you, the living organism. You are experiencing totality in a manner which is well expressed in that phrase, "as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be," in terms of totality, which includes change and transformation. But because it includes change and transformation in wholeness, the whole idea of bondage to birth and death and all that that implies is out. This is the meaning of saying that the yogi is immortal. This is the meaning of the deathless state. The entering of the Holy of Holies, the realizing of Atma. This is the meaning of the resurrection and the ascension. The entering into this state. So you see the tremendous importance of transcending speech, words, this is the meaning of the Buddha's words. The very first words he says to the five after the enlightenment. Hearken, because the deathless has been found, and the way to the deathless. This is the deathless state of awareness. This immortality does not belong to the body as we experience it. It belongs to body as totality, the total universe. The total universe is immortal. It is not finite. And it is immortal. The particular body is mortal. Hearken, because the deathless has been found. And it is found through the particular body. And this is the marvel and the mystery. And the specific purpose of our human existence on this planet. This realization of immortality along those lines. Do understand, it is not you who have gained or attained or achieved immortality. Not at all. This transcendent reality, the one total reality, has come to flower through you, the purified one, displaying the meaning of immortality in its fullness through the mortal organism. Now you see something of the awesome majesty of transcendence. It's supremacy. And it's supremacy which does not remain apart from us, away from us, but comes right down into us and through us and spreads around us. Understand this and you will understand the words of Jesus. Now, O Father, glorify thou me with the glory I had with thee before the world was. The organism is the world. And that glory was there. That glory everlastingly is there. And although the words as they stand in the gospel include the word I, the glory that I had with thee before the world was, the fact is that there is only the one transcendent real. And when that is no longer a case of words, but is a realized fact, because I myself am totally emptied, am utterly transparent, then this has become the light itself. I am the way, the truth, the life. And this I is no longer you or me, the particular individual. It is the one and only I, the supreme I. Aham, a word which the Buddha uses constantly. And yet, Buddhist psychology analytically completely dismisses self. And the word I, in our ordinary languages of the world, has significance only in relationship to the particular self. But you see, this word aham, which comes all the way down from the beginning and characterizes the Kabbalah just as much as it characterizes the Veda. This word I means that which is the unabandonable reality. The one and only total reality. And when the individual has become utterly purified and utterly selfless, all selfness is out. There is no separate I. He is so completely at one with the total reality that when he says I, the denotation, the immediate actual denotation of that word is this one total reality. So now you can see whither the religious discipline leads us. In this state, the mind has reached its full maturity. If we can really grasp this, we can appreciate why it is said that man is the crown of evolution on this planet. In the Bible it is said that man was made a little lower than the angels. But I think there is sufficient indication in the Kabbalah to show that this phrase as it stands lays itself open to misunderstanding. As I have already said, both here during this week and at our group meetings, the angelic and archangelic orders are personifications of our own awareness of the activity of the archetypal energies of pure mind. Just as there is universal matter which patterns itself in countless ways and manifests itself as you and I, different individuals, as everything that we experience and see in the universe. Just as these particular patterns of matter emerge out of the one universal matter, so too our minds as such, our psyches as such, are the expressions, the particular shapes and expressions of universal mind, which is characterless. But it is a power. It is an energy. And when that energy is sensed by us in this, that, or the other main way, we symbolize it as archangelic or angelic or as demonic. The one is concerned with the anabolic process, the building up. I'm using biological terms because we are talking of life itself. The anabolic process, and then there is the catabolic process. The catabolic process is characterized anthropomorphically as so many demons, and we call them the evil forces. There's nothing evil about it. This is the process. It is all within man. The whole of the spiritual world, which we talk about, is a projection out of our own minds. The theological systems and other cults which have existed in the world and constantly keep sprouting up say that this material world is the expression of a spiritual world which is all perfect and wonderful and so forth. Not at all. This is a separation of reality into bits. There is only one reality as such. As we experience it, we are aware of what we call the material manifestation through our senses, and as a result of our own mental processes, we project that which is non-material as a spiritual world, which is our creation. This is one of my somewhat heretical presentations, which goes contrary to everything that exists in all the other religions of the world as such. But there it is. The spiritual world is manufactured out of your brain and my brain, and it exists inside my mind only. With me it goes. So now, this deathless state, the state of fulfillment and fruition, the state which means your happiness as an individual here now, which means the fruition and the free functioning of your own intelligence here now, and which means your own spiritual freedom here now. This is the culmination of the whole process of mindfulness, of communion through the sense avenues. Remember always that the senses are the cords of communion when purified. And those aspects of meditation which transcend the musing process, which go right beyond the verbal and thought process, and you enter into that other world, the highest of the three heavens, as mentioned in connection with Yama, and which are mentioned and presented in considerable psychological detail in the Buddhist jhanas and samapattis, and that final state of cessation in which it is said that you touch nirvana with the body. We'll stop there for the moment and continue a little later. The transition of the mode of awareness from consciousness in terms of the finite and of mortality to the awareness being in which immortality is actually experienced is presented in the Upanishads in four different categories. The first is called the ordinary waking state. The next is called the dreaming state. The third is called the state of dreamless slumber. And the fourth is called the Turiya, or sometimes, especially as in the Buddhist texts, Chaturtha, the fourth stage. It's just called the fourth, which transcends all the other three. You might wonder why the transition uses the terms dream state and dreamless slumber state. There is a correspondence between the states of consciousness and that which actually happens to the body. The body here awake in the world of affairs, we all know exactly what it is. We all know something also of the dreaming state. The way consciousness is affected by the events of the day, by thoughts, feelings, ideas, anxieties, fears, and all the rest of it, by what we eat, by weather conditions outside, which give rise to what we call our dreams. We know something about that. The dreamless slumber state is the state of deep sleep, where the body and the breath rhythm are in the state of perfect harmony. And in that state, the brain is truly resting. It is in its Sabbath, so to say. In this state, desire, thought, and all the ordinary experiences of elation, excitement, anxiety, depression, they do not affect the body. That is why that dreamless slumber state is the one in which the organism is recharged with life. Life in its purity, in its perfection. One goes back, so to say, to the primordial source of things, the origin. Everything is fresh and new, and we wake up refreshed, charged again for the life of the next day and the activities of the next day. There is nothing in the psychophysical, in connection with the psychophysical organism, which corresponds to this fourth state. Now, there is a very important point to bear in mind here. The ordinary life of the psychophysical organism, the millions of people in the world, is a life characterized by unmindfulness. We are conscious only in so far as a stimulus affects us, reaches us, and we react to the stimulus. Only exceptionally have we that balance of mind and calmness which enables us to make a right response. But otherwise, we merely react helplessly, automatically to the stimulus. We are unmindful. And it is for this reason that the religious texts of the world call our waking state the state of confusion. And to use a kind word, they call it the state of sleep. Sleep. You are asleep to reality. We are asleep to truth. Because we are unmindful. We are unawake to the transcendence, to reality as reality. We know only our mental constructs. Now, with the religious discipline, you get a gradation in development which corresponds to these three states, but in terms of mindfulness. That is the difference. When we are mindful of our physical activities and our mental processes, when we are awake in the body, when we are truly mindful, then that is the proper waking state. When we have become so practiced in mindfulness that when we go to sleep, when we lie down to sleep, we send the body to sleep with the mind calm and in control, another aspect of consciousness begins to function and work purposively in that sleep, in that state of sleep of the body. And this is the swapna, they call it the dreaming state. But this dreaming is very different from the ordinary dreaming of the psychophysical organism. There is a process of inward growth taking place all the time, a spiritual growth, especially a psychological combing out, a psychological refreshing, a clarification of our perceptions, and a simplification of our feeling states. All this takes place in the dream state as such. Then there is the other dream state whilst the body is awake too. And this dream state, this term, the swapna state, is applied to those aspects of meditation which we indulge in when we deliberately sit down and go through a laid down process of meditation, a process of musing, a process of letting the mind dwell quietly upon something. In this state, the mind on its own, just as the body on its own because of nature's gift, grows, and its processes, its, so to say, mental physiology works healthily and harmoniously. And the result of that is that our perceptions become clearer and clearer, and we are able to remain in a state of calm and a perceiving calm. We understand. These two states are comprised within the realm of discursive thought and speech. But with the practice of mindfulness, this discursive thought and speech, which ordinarily is caught up completely in the realm of the 12 Nidanas, as they were called by the Buddha, the whole of the Paticchasamuppada, this discursive thought process now is changing. It's changing in such a way that the way of release into a freer condition is coming into being, usually translated into English as the escape from ill. The third state is the dreamless slumber state whilst you are awake. What is this dreamless slumber state whilst you are awake? The discursive thought and speech process has ceased to affect you. Whilst you are awake, you are mindful constantly in terms of totality, not in terms of isolative self-consciousness. That is to say, in terms of I, the seeing, observing subject, looking at and observing the observed object, that veil between self and not self is no longer there, which means that one is entering that state of communion. One is in that state of communion. And this is the dreamless slumber state, because as and when we are in that state, anxiety, fear, personal desire, the conflict between the other person or situation and oneself is out. Exactly as in the other case of the psychophysical organism, in the dreamless sleep state, there is no penetration of desire. Therefore, the organism is recharged. Now, when that happens in the waking state, not only is the organism perpetually whole, but the mind is in the innocent state. It is innocuous, that means, not harming, innocent. It is harmless. It is fresh. It is not dull. It is ever new. It is awake to the immediate here now. And it is not dragged back by the corpses of the past. Of the past moment, or of the past 50 or 60 years. The distinction between the conscious mind and the unconscious mind is disappearing. The mind becomes unified and whole. This is the flowering of the pure mind, the holy mind. The mind of the religious is a holy mind. This is not a dull mind. This is the mind that perceives immediately in the here now and is awake and naturally, spontaneously attentive to the here now, without the obstruction of the past, without the obstruction of all the pent-up, unworked-out mental impressions which troubled us before, the vasanas, as they were called. And if the vasanas are no longer active, no longer present, in fact, then there is no planning for the future. There is no concern about the future. Planning in the sense of concern, planning in the sense of bringing about something which one personally desires for oneself. Planning in other terms must of necessity go on because we live in a physical world which is subject to time. And therefore you have to foresee and act accordingly. But all these disturbing influences from within the self are absent. And this is the dreamless slumber state in full waking consciousness. That is why they have used this. This the one is in terms of the awakened state of mindfulness. The other is in the state of ignorance. It is the child in the womb state. You see? Then comes this fourth state, the Turiya, the transcendent state, in which, as the Upanishads put it, you are perpetually at one with Brahman, the total reality. In fact, the Upanishads go so far as to say, Aham Brahmasmi. I am Brahman. Perhaps verbally it would be better not to say I am Brahman, but Brahman is me. Which puts it in a form which is less liable to misinterpretation. Non-Hindu theologians have always used this as a point of attack upon the inconceivable hubris, the pride and the conceit, the spiritual pride and conceit, the devilish, I have read the phrase actually, the devilish pride and conceit of these Hindu yogis who talk of being God Almighty. But Brahman is not God Almighty. That is the point, for one thing. And the I, the aham used there, is not the separative, isolatively conscious, self-conscious I. However, that's another matter. So in this fourth state, there is that perfect state of communion, the deathless state, as the Buddha said. The deathlessness belongs to the mode of awareness, which is so awake in the immediate now that the whole process in time, in which of course uprising and passing away takes place, that whole process in time is completely subsumed in this deathless condition. Therefore, you are aware in terms of life, other life, life, other life, from moment to moment. I have used that phrase, eternity rides on the wings of time. Because if eternity were not embodied in and riding on the wings of time, eternity would be merely a word. You can spin out a concept, but it would be no reality for you. The reality of eternity is present when the attention is completely given to the here now. And in that total attentiveness, there is the manifestation of transcendence in terms of the creature called man. God walking on earth amidst mortals. This is the marvelous thing about it all, the wonderful thing. And he who is like that is very, very quiet. He's very still, he's very silent, although the body moves and his lips may utter words. But there is always that peculiar grace about his presence, which never imposes his presence upon anybody, but is as the light of the sun to anyone who has eyes to see. But it's a light that does not hurt. It's a light which never invalidates the onlooker, but takes him up into heaven, so to say. So the Upanishads have presented these four forms. And it is very interesting to note that in the Buddhist presentation, we have the four jhanas, as they are called. In the jhana means dhyana, which means attention. To give your attention is to go into dhyana. That is the meaning of dhyana. Now, we talked in terms of yoga all the way up to from Yama and Niyama up to Pratyahara and Dharana. You remember? We have done that during the week. And here now we come to the two final stages, the Dhyana and the Samadhi. The four jhanas as presented in Buddhism are of exceptional importance for the student to understand the whole matter psychologically. The first jhana still has discursive thought in it. And you remember in the talk of the first afternoon here, where I tried to sum up the different aspects of meditation, mindfulness, the discursive meditation process, in which of course speech is still active, and that part of meditation which transcends speech. In the first jhana, this discursive part is present. Now comes the next step, which really is practically the most important and the most difficult one. If you do that, everything else is there. It is said that by the going down of discursive thought, the bhikkhu enters the second jhana. It's an astonishing thing. It really is an astonishing thing that this which is of such vital importance, the most important aspect of it all, is just casually mentioned by the going down of the discursive thought process. Vittaka and vichara. By the going down of it, he enters upon the second meditation, in which there is still rapture, happiness, mindfulness, clear consciousness, equanimity. All those are still there. But this is the very crux of the thing. Because, as I've tried to put before you earlier, the cessation of discursive thought and the flow of words means the release out of the awareness of existence in terms of finitude and mortality into infinity and immortality. Recall again the words of the Buddha, "Hearken, bhikkhus, the deathless has been found." And he says in another context, "Open are the doors of the immortal." You see? So, here this very important thing happens. This cessation of chatter of every sort. Which means the quietness, the silence. And when that quietness and silence comes into being, it means also that all isolative self-consciousness, I am I, disappears. The life current is now functioning in a different way. Instead of I drawing everything to myself in the world, we have long passed drawing physical things, of course, but mental things, ideas, what we call understanding of principles, of truths, and so forth. After all that is drawn unto myself in terms of discursive thought and speech. So there is always the self center there, that has vanished. When the discursive thought process stops. And when that has vanished, the Son of Man, I'm using a useful Christian phrase there, the Son of Man is truly, to use the Upanishadic phrase, the Manasa Putra. Putra is son, Manas, mind. The Manasa Putra, he's the Son of Mind. Pure mind. Which means universal mind. Which means that you are really touching the state of awareness being. And in the third, from the third jhana to the fourth jhana, there is the complete going down of all sorrow and of all joy. And you enter the state of perfect mindfulness and equanimity, the completely purified state. Now make no mistake here, the going down of all sorrow. This does not mean our petty little sorrows and troubles and problems of everyday life. We have long passed that, even with the first jhana coming to fruition. That's long past. But there is another sorrow. And this is a transcendental sorrow. This sorrow is, I think, finds, I believe, its most perfect expression in the Chandogya Upanishad, when Narada approaches Sanat Kumara and says to him, "Demonstrate Brahman." "Adihi Bhagava," he says. Now, of course, the words are so cryptic that no amount of intellectual activity will reveal what is implied in just those two words. Bhagava simply means Lord. The fortunate Lord, he who has realized. He says, "Adihi" means discourse, teach me. But actually, when the disciple approaches one who has realized, and in this case the one who had realized is named Sanat Kumara, the ever virgin youth, everlastingly young, immortal, wonderful. When he uses those words, he means teach me in such a way, get into such a relationship with me, that with your state of consciousness, a spiritual induction shall take place, which will lift up my awareness into your realm. This is what it is. You have it in the Old Testament, in the Elijah-Elisha story, before Elijah is taken up into heaven. And Sanat Kumara says, "Tell me what you already know, and I'll teach you further after that." Narada gives the list of all that he knows. He's a walking encyclopedia. But, says Narada, "It has been heard by me that there are those who have gone beyond all sorrow, who have realized the Atma. I have not realized the Atma. I know only the words. Only the words. But not the Atma, the ultimate real. Such a sorrowing one am I. Do you, sir, show me how to cross over this sorrow?" This is the transcendental sorrow. And it's a very interesting thing that the Buddha uses the word shoka precisely as Narada uses it, and the Chandogya Upanishad precedes the age of the Buddha. It precedes it that the Buddha uses the word shoka there instead of using the word dukkha. It's very interesting. So we understand that the crossing over of sorrow is not just in this world of duality. There is this transcendental sorrow. The non-realization, the state of standing outside the door of heaven. So, with that third jhana, after the third jhana, with the going down of all his sorrow and his joy. Now, if there is the going down of all that sorrow, which is bound up with the discursive process, with the becoming process, the birth-death process, it means that your mode of awareness of existence has undergone a tremendous transformation. Then one enters that state of perfect mindfulness in which there is no separation whatsoever from totality. Then there are no problems of good and evil. You embrace everything. It is there. And you don't grasp at anything. And in that non-grasping is nirvana. take that other meaning of nirvana, extinction, blown out. What is blown out? What is extinguished? Not my personal sorrow or difficulty or problem or drawback or any such thing. But the whole state, the whole consciousness, in terms of the ill state, is blown out. There's the complete extinction of all greed and hate and delusion, ambition, envy, fear, the complete extinction of all that. And there is the state of the deathless prevailing. So much in individual terms. But that which is in individual terms has a correspondence in universal terms. And these are the samapattis, as they are called in Buddhist formulation. And samapatti means coalescence. It is as if from the world, one moves out of the world of differentiation, that is to say, moves in consciousness, not in physical fact, obviously, that you move out of the world of differentiation into the world of the undifferentiated. This does not mean that you go back to primordial chaos when there was no manifestation. But it means that because your awareness has grown in that manner, there is no separation, no separativeness, you are in perfect relationship with all and everything, whatsoever there is. In perfect relationship. And because you are in perfect relationship with any one thing, you are in perfect relationship with everything else, because the cosmos is constituted that way. And it is that eternal order of things which underlies the cosmos has been forgotten, has been destroyed by us through our tanha, our craving and our violence and all the rest of it, that it has disappeared out of human life. And now, at last, it comes back again. See? This is one of the deep meanings of the right remembrance. You never forget God, to put it in theistic terms. You are everlastingly listening to God, which means obedience, ob audire. There is no disappearance. The sin of Adam, when he failed for a moment to listen to God, is wiped out. You are in the state of perfect listening. And the Sanskrit, to listen, shruti, means also revelation. It is this which gives you revelation. And in this revelation, this condition of revelation in which you are, now the whole of the manifested universe as such has become a unity for you. A very real thing. It's terribly difficult to say anything about these things. Still, I will try to, it might stimulate you helpfully somewhere, somehow. You enter upon and abide in the plane of infinite akasha. Akasha means mind space, fundamentally. But the ordinary meaning is space in our ordinary sense, all this space. You see? But akasha really means mind space. Because it is out of that, and it is out of that mind space that the manifested and the particular emerges, which means a concretization into particularity of that which is non-particular and infinitely spread. It's terrible using these words, but there it is. So this infinity of akasha will imply the total manifested universe, Not merely materially, but manifested in terms of thought and idea and feeling and everything that you can grasp. And this has its counterpart, which is inextricably interwoven with it, namely consciousness itself, vijnana. The two are at one. Hence, you enter upon the infinity of vijnana. The infinity of akasha and the infinity of vijnana coalesce into, become integrated into what is described as the no thing. Here there is nothing. There are too many people who bandy this word, the void. Here is void of everything. You have to realize it before you use it. Otherwise, you will misapply it. It is not void in the sense of nothingness. It is not void in the sense of that which is not alive. It is all alive. It's life, other life state. It is the no thing, this fundamental energy, this creative energy, which is everlastingly at work. And in that no-thingness, there is neither perception nor non-perception by the individual person. Now, do not mistake the meaning of this term perception when applied to such states of consciousness. When we say perceive, we mean that there is a sense activity, a sense functioning, which affects our nervous system and the brain. And because we have developed this speech faculty which integrates these impressions, we make a mental verbal pattern of it. Mental and verbal pattern of it. And we call that a perception, quite rightly. Now this, when the Buddha uses the word perception and the word feeling in this transcendent context, it has no relationship to this. Because we've gone quite beyond the realm of discursive thought and speech. And this is what is not understood in connection with these deep states of consciousness. And you will appreciate that it being so difficult to talk about it, that is why throughout the discourses you merely get this list of the eight, the four jhanas, the four samapatis. You merely get the list thrown out at you all the time. And nothing is expounded, so to say, because it is beyond exposition, in fact. But when you are in that state, that perception, that feeling, simply means that you are it. That is why I always hyphenate these two words, awareness being. You are it. You know it by being it, not by perceiving it at a distance. That which you are, you can't put out at a distance. There is no distance. There is no mind space which separates you from another. All otherness has vanished completely. And when there is a cessation of that perception, that kind of perception and feeling, that is the ultimate that man's consciousness can ever realize. That is to say, man as he is at present constituted. And here there is the supreme realization, the true unio mystica of the mystic, whether he be Christian or Sufi or Hindu or anybody. This is the true unio mystica, the ultimate reality, in which the self, the separate self, has completely vanished. But there is this actual vivid awareness, this real awareness, beyond words, beyond all thought. This is the meaning of the phrase, there is a world beyond. The Buddha uses it constantly. He affirms it categorically. He affirms the transcendent. So now, something like this is the course which is run. And do not think that a person reaches that other shore. That other shore has come into oneself. And the distinction between this shore and that shore is out. I don't know, I never can know, the mystery of transcendence. But there is that in each of us as an individual which can touch that, which can touch that mystery. And that mystery completely takes you up into its eternal heart, where there is unending light and peace and bliss.